arrow-like in shape. Its branches were not as full as several of the other family sigils, but still robust and proud. "Damn it all," he thought, feeling a weariness creep into him. And here he'd been hoping, however in vain, that the culprit would be a random thief, one without ties to their hidden world. Nicholas supposed he would never be so lucky.
"Hemlock," he began.
"Did my grandfather send you?" Sophia interrupted.
The girl scowled.
"I will never work for him, not even if he were to offer a fair price for my services."
A mercenary, then. He'd heard stories about them from the hall, members of the Jacaranda and Hemlock families who had refused to bow to Ironwood once he seized control of their travelers and guardians and absorbed them into his own clan. They offered their services to any traveler or guardian who could pay them. He'd always wondered about the kinds of jobs they took, assuming they were mostly occupied with tracking down wayward family members or lost possessions, or maybe even quietly making small changes to history that wouldn't result in the timeline shifting.
"Call me Li Min," she said. "I'll call you Jackass if it suits me," Sophia snapped. "Tell me what you're doing here before I take this knife and slice you from gullet to gut."
Nicholas wondered briefly if it was his destiny to be surrounded by women possessing various degrees of murderous intent. The girl smiled.
"This is no way to speak to one with whom you wish to do business."
Sophia sucked in a sharp breath, filling the bellows of her chest to explode. But Nicholas was quicker on the draw.
"We have no business with you beyond retrieving our letter. I don't suppose you'd be so kind as to offer any sort of explanation for why you took it, who hired you to steal it,
and why you are here, dangling it in front of us, if someone paid you to take it. Unless, of course, she was angling to dip into two different pots of profit, hoping he and Sophia would bribe her for a look.
"I never said I was hired," Li Min said. "It is in my interest to know the business of the travelers I come across. Work is hard to find, you see, and occasionally I must look for it, rather than wait for it to come to me. Many Ironwoods have traveled here in recent months, but imagine my surprise to see a Linden Guardian scuttling around the beaches like a little crab. And then you appeared to conduct your business."
Unsure of whether or not he'd live to regret it, Nicholas lowered his pistol and returned it to its place at his side. Feeling steadier, he began to consider their situation in this new light.
"If you stole it to ransom it back to us, then you already know we have nothing with which to pay you," he said, sweeping his arms out to indicate their sorry state of affairs.
"I wish to know what the letter says," the girl said. "It is written in a peculiar way. I will give it back to you on two conditions." "I'll take it from your dead body."
Sophia swung an arm out, her fist barreling through the air. Nicholas saw it happening, felt that wrench of dismay, as Sophia misjudged the distance between her and the other girl by nearly a foot. Li Min easily dodged, her face passive, as Sophia lost her balance and slammed into the sand, sending up a spray of it. Sophia raised a hand to her eye patch, nearly howling in frustration. It wasn't the first time Nicholas had seen her struggle with her altered vision, and it wasn't the first time his heart had given an unwelcome, involuntary clench at the sight, either. Li Min forced her dark gaze up from the girl, back to him.
"I will give you this letter, and you will show me how to read it."
Nicholas shook his head.
"Unacceptable."
If the writing was peculiar, he had a feeling it was written in the way Rose had coded the other letters to Etta, a calculated risk on Rose's part, because what if Etta hadn't shown Nicholas how to decode them? And he was loath to reveal that secret to anyone outside the family. The envelope emerged from inside of Li Min's shirt, stained brown by the ale, rumpled and worn, but in one piece. That is, until the girl ripped it in half. Nicholas and Sophia both lurched toward her, crying out.
"If I do not read it, you will not read it," Li Min warned,
her voice shifting from its airy tone to flint. And to make her point, she turned the halves to the side and began to rip them into quarters. Sophia turned to look up at Nicholas.
"It's not worth it. Let her have the damn letter. We already have our plan,"
but it would save us time. Tracking Etta would be a simpler thing if we could have the last common year now, without delay, Nicholas thought.
Don't do it, Carter, Sophia warned, voice low.
I will not show you how to read it.
Nicholas held up his hand, stilling Li Min.
But I will read to you what it says.
Unacceptable, Li Min said, mimicking his tone. You might deceive me.
You accuse me of being dishonorable, Nicholas said.
What does an Ironwood know of honor? Li Min wondered aloud, waving the pieces of the letter at him.
My name is Nicholas Carter, he said. I am an Ironwood by only half my blood, and never in character. If nothing else, I am honor-bound to the Linden family not to show a stranger the sole way they have of communicating with each other, without Ironwood being able to discover their secrets. You can understand that, I think, given your line of work.
The Linden family is dead, Li Min said, eyes lighting up with obvious curiosity. Only a few guardians remain.
Their methods work, then, Nicholas said. If you have not discovered that some of their travelers are still very much alive.
Li Min inclined her head toward him, giving him that much at least. I will accept this condition, then. But I have one other.
The girl was smiling again, and within the span of less than an hour, he'd already learned to fear the implications of that expression. His mind began to take tally of what little they had, and he braced himself for the loss of any of it.
Go on, then.
As my payment, I would like a kiss, she said, glancing between the two of them. A proper one.
Nicholas paused. Of all the things he'd suspected she would ask for, flintlock pistols, shoes, a favor, a signed confirmation of debt, a kiss. He stared at her a good long while, waiting for her to give the true price. But she simply gazed back, her dark eyes unwavering. Nicholas had kissed a number of women in his 20 years of life. Not as many as Chase, but then even Lothario could not top that tally. He was far, far from being a saint. But at some point over the past few weeks, his heart had resolved that it only wanted to kiss one girl ever again, and his whole spirit seemed to retreat at the thought of kissing another. I could kiss her forehead. Her cheek, he thought quickly. She hadn't specified where or how. Do it, Carter. He pressed his hands to his thighs, trying to steady the rioting dismay. Get the matter over with. Read the letter and go. That was all that mattered now. He would not think of Etta, the way she'd tasted of rain when she'd kissed him in the jungle. How he could have sworn there were stars in her hair that night in Damascus. The way she made him feel solid and terribly brave. Well, his mind was unhelpful.
All right, he said, resigned. Let's have it, then.
Li Min took a step back, dark brows rising over her forehead in both amusement and disdain.
I was speaking to her.
It was physically painful to exist inside the long stretch of silence that followed. Oh. The wheels of his mind began to turn again. Her.
Oh, well, that's... It's certainly...
Sophia had begun to collect their scattered belongings, grumbling every curse and oath known to mankind, none too quietly. At Li Min's words, she slowly began to straighten.
Ma'am, I apologize,
Nicholas said sincerely, inclining his head.
Forgive my presumption.
Li Min flicked her fingers dismissively in his direction.
It can be hard for men to believe they are not all gods walking the earth, as so many women are forced to fall at their feet.
He lifted a shoulder in a faint shrug. Where was the lie in that?
And you expect me to fall at your feet now? Sophia asked, her expression surprisingly even.
No one expects that, Nicholas said. It's your choice. As you said before, we have other avenues of inquiry to pursue. She can take the letter and be damned.
Oh, I have your permission to refuse, then. Sophia rolled her eye.
I only meant to make it clear.
He closed his mouth, knowing he'd botched this moment beyond repair.
Fine, Sophia said, cutting him off.
She squared her shoulders, glancing back at him as she stepped toward the other girl.
We could go on without the bloody letter, but if it helps us find the men who... I just want this to be over with.
Nicholas didn't miss the catch in her voice when she said, the men.
Have at it,
Sophia said, removing her hat. She stood straight in front of Li Min, who mirrored her stoic expression. Nicholas had the peculiar sense that he was watching a duel, with neither of the aggrieved parties willing to fire into the air. He kept a hand on the unloaded pistol at his side, and was startled to find that Sophia was not doing the same. Rather, she was holding her ground, waiting for the other young woman to approach. Sophia's throat worked as she swallowed with some difficulty. Li Min brought a hand to her face, and curled a loose strand of dark hair behind the other girl's ear. With a tenderness that made Nicholas want to avert his gaze, Li Min leaned forward.
"I'll wait," she said, her lips a breath from Sophia's. "One day you may be willing to pay, and I will delight in collecting."
Sophia's face, already flushed from the sun, deepened to crimson as Li Min offered the halves of Rose's letter to her. She snatched the parchment away and thrust it in Nicholas's direction, never once taking her eyes off the mercenary.
"Read it."
Nicholas felt the knots around his lungs ease, and briny air filled them, tempered with the scent of the rotting green flesh of the jungle. He moved a short distance away from the young women, and sat down on the bowed body of a fallen palm tree. With great care, he lined up the raw, torn edges. "Dear little heart, the center of my being." It went on to discuss the weather, King George III, and so on, like tiny riots of nonsense across the page. Nicholas felt his brows rise as he reached up and wiped the sweat from his forehead. The endearment would read as a bit much to the casual reader, but Etta had explained to him that, in the absence of a key to read it, the way to decode the letter was embedded within the salutation. She'd used star before, and heart was easy enough. Though what to make of little? And the curious inclusion of the center of my being. Unless... He curled his index fingers and thumbs together, forming a heart, and positioned it at the center of the parchment. The message it revealed was still padded with gibberish, and he couldn't make sense of it until he imagined the shape of a small heart laid over the words at the center of the letter. "Cannot meet you. Will lead the shadows away from you as long as I can. For year, seek Belladonna." Another blasted riddle. The paper wrinkled under the force of his grip as he read the message aloud to the young women. "Bloody Rose Linden."
"Interesting," Sophia said, something sparking in her eyes. "Dare I say it, but the woman might have actually come through for us. I hadn't considered it as an option, but she's on to something."
"Foolish," Li Min shot back.
"And you were right not to consider it."
"I would prefer to know what it is the two of you are referring to, rather than watch you argue the point," Nicholas said with a patience he did not know he still possessed.
Sophia ignored Li Min's look of disbelief, saying,
"There are two people in all of time that know the workings of our world, who make it a point to know everything everyone is doing. One of them is Grand... is Ironwood himself. And the other is the Belladonna."
"Belladonna is a she, not a thing," he confirmed,
trying to extinguish the eagerness in his voice.
"Julian never spoke of her," Sophia asked him at his look of confusion. "She's... I'm not quite sure how to put this. She seeks out treasures lost to time, and holds auctions for them. Only instead of paying in gold, you pay for them in favors and secrets. Ironwood has allowed it because, generally speaking, these treasures must stay lost to preserve his timeline."
"What is it that you hope to accomplish with this visit?" Li Min asked.
The sunlight gleamed off her coal-black hair as she cocked her head to the side.
"Perhaps you might purchase the information from me instead."
"What business is it of yours?" Nicholas asked.
In truth, he was mildly concerned about what she might ask for next, and whether or not he could trust her answer.
I told you. It's my business to know others' business.
We are attempting to uncover the last common year with this most recent major shift in the timeline, Nicholas said. Is that information you possess?
There was a single beat in which his hopes shot into the air like a firework, only to crash back down a moment later. Li Min glanced off toward the turquoise water.
No. I could. I might seek the answer for you, however. For a handsome fee, Sophia burst in. Trying to poach some business from the Belladonna, are you? No, thank you. We'll go to someone who will actually know, not a second-rate mercenary who can't even decode a message.
Sophia ignored Li Min's light laugh and turned back to Nicholas.
The Belladonna knows everything. Julian told me that on his last visit accompanying the old man, she rattled off the full scale of all of Ironwood's comings and goings, and the supposedly secret changes he'd enacted.
And your quarrel with her is? Nicholas asked, turning back to Li Min.
He did not entirely like the sound of this, aside from potentially having a more direct, guaranteed route to Etta. Li Min lifted a shoulder, but her gaze darted over to Sophia, just for a moment, as she pressed her lips into a tight line.
"She's bought into the rumors that the woman is a witch," Sophia said with obvious ridicule. "That she'll ensnare your soul. Ridiculous."
Nicholas did balk at that. Witch was a strong accusation in his native time, and flung around far too quickly when it came to ladies with unusual interests or predispositions. Lehman's lips parted, but after a moment she only smiled. Tossing her long braid over her shoulder again, she bent to retrieve her cape and hat.
"You seem to have your path charted, then. Be well."
She was several feet away and retreating into the palms before Nicholas's mind took note that she was leaving.
"That's it," Sophia called after her. "After all that, that's it?"
Li Min didn't miss a stride as she called back.
"For now. Until we meet again."
When it looked as though she might try to follow the other girl, to haul her back for further interrogation, Nicholas caught Sophia's shoulder with one hand and used the other to tuck Rosa's correspondence back in his jacket pocket.
"Can you believe the nerve of that girl?"
"Sophia," he interrupted. "A witch. Is there anything else I should know?"
"Oh, we'll be fine," Sophia said, turning from the trail of broken underbrush Li Min had left behind.
"Are you personally acquainted with her?" he pressed.
"Well, no, but she is a legend, and between Julian's stories and the old man's absolute loathing of her, I feel as though I've a handle on her," Sophia said quickly. "I can't believe I didn't think of this. The only thing we have to worry about now is finding a passage to Prague. She operates in the 15th century. I think there should be a passage to Spain if we can reach Florida. And from there..."
"Not to interrupt your planning, but how do you propose we buy passage off this island?"
Sophia cocked her head to the side, her lips curling up at the edges as she lifted a fist-sized leather bag from inside of her jacket and tossed it to him.
"Some thief she is. Didn't even notice when I cut this from her belt."
Nicholas actually laughed, unknotting the laces to reveal enough gold coins to momentarily stop his heart.
"She'll be back for this."
Sophia glanced back at the path Li Min had taken.
"Good."
San Francisco, 1906. 7. They returned to the same room Etta had climbed out of, accompanied by a different pair of guards, as well as a maid who her father... She shook her head, clearing the impossible word from it. Who the man had practically flung at her. Also joining them was a tall, silver-haired woman with posture so severe Etta wondered if it would be possible to break a wooden chair against her spine. No one had introduced them, but Etta was reasonably sure this was the Winifred the man had spoken of.
"You may proceed,"
the older woman told the maid. Etta would have been shocked if the girl was even 17. She peered out from beneath a heavy mop of dark curls, escaping from a loose braid,
The girl was curious, but not at all frightened or overawed, which made Etta think she was likely a guardian, someone connected to the thorns. The lantern in her hands made fragments of light jump around them on the thick carpets and gilded wallpaper, fluttering like newly disturbed ghosts.
"A little privacy would be nice," Etta told the older woman.
The old blade reached behind her to lock the door. Etta raised a brow, taking in the dark violet of her dress. It looked painfully cinched at the waist, with a trail of small pearl buttons that ran up the bodice to the place her tight collar ended, just beneath her chin. The silk shirt was draped with all the elegant ease of a waterfall, collecting in a slight bustle at the small of her back. After rummaging through the wardrobe, the maid pulled out a plain white blouse with a little dark embroidery around the collar, and a long gray skirt that looked to be made of wool. It was cut narrowly at the waist and along the thighs, but flared as it got closer to the knees and brushed the floor. The poor girl seemed to realize at the exact moment Etta did that there was an icicle's chance in summer that the tiny waist would fit her.
"I'll let it out. It won't be but a moment," the girl swore,
her gaze darting to Winifred. A moment too long, apparently. With an irritated look, Winifred turned back to Etta and ordered,
"Strip."
"Can I get a please?" Etta grumbled, eyeing the very familiar garment in the woman's hands.
"I'm not wearing the corset. Absolutely not."
Winifred seized the scruff of Etta's nightgown and yanked it hard over her head. Momentarily blinded by the fabric, Etta reached up, trying to loosen the ribbon before it strangled her or tore off an ear. She crossed her arms over her chest, shielding her body as the woman threw her a thin chemise. It occurred to Etta that the woman was literally and figuratively stripping her, trying to make her feel as vulnerable as possible, and that she shouldn't simply let her do it without a fight. When she tried to twist away from her, Winifred shoved her off balance, dropping the corset over her head, and began to lace it up before Etta caught her next breath. The woman handed her another thin, sleeveless top to pull over the corset. Etta resented the little cheerful pink ribbons on it almost as much as the woman's smirk.
"You poor creature. You've your mother's sorry figure."
"Touch me again, and I'll show you how alike we are," Etta spat out. Winifred had already turned away, retrieving the blouse and newly let-out skirt from the maid. She threw them at Etta's feet.
"With haste, you stupid child," she said when Etta did not immediately do as she was told. "The Grand Master won't be pleased if he's kept waiting."
Etta's temper flared at the word child, singeing whatever restraint she might have had left. That was the only explanation she had for why she said,
"Cyrus Ironwood is the Grand Master."
The slap came so suddenly that Etta could not have dodged it if she had enough time to try. She careened back onto the bed, pressing her hand to the burning skin on her face.
"Look what you made me do," the woman growled. "Such insolence! And after I cared for you, washed you, tended to your courses, and with nary a complaint. If he hadn't asked it of me, I would have smothered you from the start."
"You are insane," Etta informed her, fists already clenched.
"Hit me again, and your friends will be picking pieces of you out of the rug."
The maid blanched, but Etta didn't care. She didn't. She was shaking now with the full force of her fury, embarrassment, and resentment. She tried to quell the hurricane of emotions swirling in her chest as she finished dressing, and was forced to sit at the vanity and have her hair braided. She avoided looking in the mirror, unwilling to see the throbbing red mark across her cheek.
"Hardly acceptable," Winifred said, once the ordeal was over. "But follow me."
Etta knew she needed to go with her if she wanted to confirm the thorns had the astrolabe, but obeying this woman felt like swallowing seawater. It incinerated her throat, choking her.
"I think I'll stay," Etta said, crossing her arms over her chest.
The woman's hand reached out, and Etta instinctively struck her arm out to block the hit. Only the woman wasn't aiming for another slap. Her other hand came up and fisted into Etta's braid, twisting so tightly that Etta yelped in pain.
"Let me go!"
Instead, the woman dragged her across the room, never once breaking her stride as Etta kicked and scratched at her to release her grip. the door opened to the other guard's wide-eyed shock. And as he fumbled for his words, the woman continued on her path, letting Etta's bare feet drag and burn across the carpet, down the stairs. There really was some sort of party happening on the first floor. As Winifred hauled her across a gallery hallway, Etta could hear the excited chatter and laughter, even as a man poured himself into playing a jaunty tune on a piano. The smell of liquor and perfume permeated the air as they passed the door of the library, with Julian's amused face peering out.
"Atta girl," he called after them. "Keep fighting, kiddo." "Stop calling me that," she snarled back,
gritting her teeth as his laughter chased them down the hall. And finally to another door, this one guarded by three men in fine suits. Winifred released her grip on Etta's hair, and Etta righted herself. Two of the men blanched at the sight of her. The other twitched a heavy brow in her direction, struggling to swallow his laugh as he gave Etta a pitying look.
"Come now, Winnie. She's just a girl. Have a care." "Her girl," Winifred said, pounding on the door. "Never forget this."
"Come in,"
came the immediate reply. Not an invitation, of course, but a command. Etta had arrived ready to fight, her pulse raging as she huffed. "Calm down. Calm down. Remember the plan." She had to find out if they had the astrolabe, and try to figure out how to get it away from them to destroy it once and for all. The guards fell back as Etta was pushed inside by the older woman, her hand twisted in the loose fabric of Etta's blouse, to ensure, she guessed, that she didn't try to make one last run for it. Instead, she passed through the threshold at her full height, trying not to glare. This office had been decorated in a similar style to the library, all masculine dark wood and jewel tones. It aimed to be impressive, and hit the mark. The window captured much the same view of the crippled landscape, along with the first hint of dawn brightening the sky. There were already four people in the room, seated around the stately desk at its center. Etta's eyes landed on the woman first, taking in her tailored skirt suit and the dark hair she'd curled and twisted into victory rolls. The older man beside her wore plain linen trousers and a tunic, both almost entirely hidden beneath his leather chest plate and sword belt. His long gray hair was slicked back from his bearded face, with small silver beads braided into several of the strands that grazed the fur pelt draped over his shoulders. To his right was a young Asian man, wearing a kimono in a shade of blue usually found only in the deepest heart of the ocean. An incredulous laugh bubbled up inside her at the sight of them. Etta inhaled a deep breath through her nose, letting the smell of wax and wood polish settle her. Henry Hemlock sat behind the desk, his feet crossed and propped up on it. The others turned to look at Etta and Winifred, and then back at Henry, shifting uncomfortably in their seats. Henry Hemlock, however, continued on with what he was saying.
"I hear you, Elizabeth. I do. The last thing I want is for your children to go to sleep worrying you won't be there in the morning. So many of us lived through that time and suffered for it. I'll take another look at the postings and see if anyone is amenable to a switch."
The woman's shoulders slumped in relief.
"Thank you. Thank you."
"We shouldn't delay in meeting them, sir, if the situation is as dire as the message seems to convey," said the man with the long silver hair. "We must help them and secure our advantage before making any changes to our personnel. In fact, I think I should go round up John and Abraham before meeting the rest of you here."
Henry grinned.
"Perhaps leaving the fur behind."
The man laughed, stroking the tufts of it.
"I think I'd make quite a statement stomping down the Seine."
"And cause a disastrous change for a laugh, I suppose," Winifred said, with ice in her voice.
Etta counted more than one set of eyes rolling in that room.
"You'd try to shoot a star down from the sky for shining too brightly," the man groused back. "All right," Henry said, taking his feet off the desk and standing.
Everyone in the room, except Etta, pivoted to follow his path back and forth as he began to pace.
"That's enough. You know how I feel about this sort of sniping. Remember, there's a true enemy out there to aim at.
Yes, of course, Winifred breathed, the very essence of sweetness, even as her grip on Etta tightened.
I don't think we've considered the fact that he, too, could be dead, and that Ironwood might already have the astrolabe,
the Japanese man interjected, leaning over to poke at an open letter.
Who else could they mean by shadows? Who else has the resources to hunt the brothers the way he describes?
What? Etta felt the moment tilt sharply beneath her feet, the realization its own earthquake.
If it was so easy, we would have done so decades past, Henry said, turning his gaze onto Etta. You seem surprised. Almost as if, perhaps, you'd expected to find the astrolabe with us.
Etta said nothing, only turned her face away, to stare at the place where the wood floors met the carpets. There was a kind of lure in his dark gaze. His focus tracked her every shift and breath. The weight of it registered so strongly it felt as if he'd put his hands on her shoulders and was stubbornly trying to turn her back toward him. She didn't want him to have easy access to her thoughts, not when her mind was racing like this, trying to keep pace with her thundering heart. It had been 2 weeks since the two Thorns, along with Sophia, had wrested the astrolabe from her in Damascus. They should have been able to create a passage directly back to the rest of the Thorns here in San Francisco. But from what she'd understood of their conversation, not only had they not brought the astrolabe, they'd disappeared altogether. And there had been no word at all from Sophia, who'd gone with them.
All we've seen are the Ironwoods he's sent out to try to rewrite our changes in small ways, Henry said. Were it in his possession, Cyrus wouldn't have hesitated to use it, to reset the timeline back to his own. It's greed and greed alone that compels his family. And let's not forget, the Silver Man said with a chuckle. We both have Ironwood on our mother's side. No, Henry said with a quick smile. Let's. But my point stands. We must trust in Kadir's ability to get to safety, and in our own to ensure we can get to him in time and retrieve the astrolabe from where he's hidden it. I'm sorry to cut the celebration short, but tell the others to make ready to travel in the morning. And we'll need to leave at least some travelers to support the Guardians staying here to watch the children.
A wise decision, Winifred gushed.
Etta tried not to gag. The others nodded, and sensing they'd reached the end of the conversation, rose as one. They brushed past Etta, one at a time, each stealing a last look at her. For a second she could have sworn the man with silver hair gave a little shudder.
Please have a seat, Henrietta. Winifred, thank you. That will be all. Ensure we're not disturbed.
The older woman bobbed a slight curtsy, giving Etta's back a parting pinch, hard enough to make her jump forward a step. Etta waited until the woman had vanished through the door in a swirl of dark skirts, before turning to Henry and spitting out. She doesn't travel through passages, does she? She sacrifices a puppy and flies through the centuries on her broom. He gave a sharp cough into his hand.
I assure you, your great-aunt is quite loving, Henry said,
only to stop and reconsider.
That is, she's quite loving in her own way. Every other Sunday. In May. Won't you sit?
Great-aunt? No way in hell. Etta didn't sit, her hands curled around the back of the chair so tightly its joints creaked.
The first thing I want you to know is that you are safe here, he said,
not breaking his gaze.
You have nothing to fear from myself or anyone here. I've taken measures to ensure your safety from Ironwood as well. Unless you choose to go looking for him, he will no longer concern himself with you.
That seemed unlikely. Before she could press the point, Henry turned his attention to shuffling through the unruly stack of opened correspondence and parchment piled into small, unsteady mountains on his desk. He seemed to find what he was looking for. He pulled a black velvet sack out from under the mess and dumped something into his palm. A gold earring. A hoop decorated with pearl, blue beads, and tiny gold leaves. Mom's earring. Etta's whole self seemed to tense in belated panic. One hand rose to touch her ears, only to find both of them free of jewelry.
"Winifred found this in the folds of your clothing when you were brought to us," he said, offering it to her. "I thought you might like it back."
"Just one?" The question hung in her mind, quiet with devastation. In the grand scheme of everything that had happened, losing an earring was hardly the worst failure she'd endured. But it was another betrayal of trust, another way she had let her mother down. She couldn't add yet another notch to that tally by falling prey to this man's lies. "You keep it. I found it in some junky old thrift shop." Henry's lips compressed at that, and when he did speak, there was a new edge to the words.
"I realize you are out of your depth, and I am quite sympathetic to all that you've been through. But one thing I cannot tolerate is lying, and another is disrespecting your family. You did not find these earrings in a thrift store. I imagine they were a gift from your mother, as I know they were a cherished gift from her beloved uncle's wife."
He knows about his son. That didn't prove anything. He and the others had talked about having many sources out there. He could have easily learned about Hassan that way. Even that his wife was the one who gave her the earrings. Etta began to bite her lip, but forced herself to stop. She would not give in to the temptation to fill the uneasy silence between them with chatter. Not when Henry seemed so comfortable in it, and was watching her so closely. "Who did you bribe for that information?" she asked, taking the earring from him. One corner of his mouth kicked up, and he opened the same drawer, retrieving a long velvet case. Resting inside was a strand of glistening pearls, each slightly irregular in shape. Every third pearl was nestled between breathtaking sapphires.
"Samara made them to match this necklace I commissioned upon our engagement. Is that proof enough for you?"
At that, Etta did sit down. Henry placed the jewelry case between them. Engagement. Engagement. Memory clouded her mind, dulling all of the certainties with which she had walked into the office. "But, darling, who's your father?" Alice had asked her in London. "Henrietta. Is it possibly Henry?"
"I'll have another earring made to match," he told her. "Or we might adjust it to be worn as a necklace. Whichever you'd prefer."
Etta felt like she was barreling down a road at night without a brake pedal. This wasn't right. It wasn't him. This man couldn't be her father.
"I don't want anything from you," she said. "And yet it's my duty to provide for you," Henry said. "At least grant me that much. I'm nearly 18 years behind on the matter."
"I can take care of things myself," Etta said.
"Yes," he said with a faint laugh. "That seems likely, given your mother. It's rather remarkable, you know, the resemblance between the two of you. Uncanny, even."
"Yeah, I didn't miss the folks in the hall who crossed themselves when they saw me," Etta said dryly. Henry didn't seem to hear her. He was carefully studying her face, his hand absently ruffling his dark hair.
"But she gave you my name.
Is it possibly Henry?" There seemed to be a question buried in the words, but his voice trailed off. He looked away, focusing on the empty bookshelves on the other side of the room. It gave Etta the opportunity to study him again, to prove to herself and that small, chiming part of her heart that there was no resemblance there to be found.
"I don't know what to tell you," she admitted.
"He who dares not grasp the thorn should never crave the rose," as Bronte said.
There was a wry expression on Henry's face as he continued.
"She has always been fiercely intelligent and determined, but she held herself apart from most others, for her own protection, to give herself distance if she'd ever needed to run. Capturing her heart was like wrestling a bear. I still have the scars to show for it."
Etta, not for the first time or even the 20th, wished she had a better grip on the timeline of her mother's life. When she had left the Thorns, when she had gone to infiltrate the Ironwoods, and when she had ultimately betrayed both by hiding the astrolabe and disappearing into the future. But it fit. All of this fit. Is it possibly Henry? More than possible. Ada brought her hand to her face, pressing her fingers hard to her temples, as if that could ease the pounding there. Her shoulder complained each time she shifted, but the pain only chiseled down her thoughts to their bare truths. Each small argument, each scrap of evidence, was beginning to form an undeniable picture. She wanted Nicholas. She wanted to see his face, and measure his thoughts against her own until they made sense. Etta hadn't understood how she'd used his steady resolve as a shelter until it was gone, and she was raw and exposed and trapped. When she'd been orphaned, she'd left the braver parts of herself with him, and what was left of her now was too cowardly to admit what she already knew to be true.
"It was for her, as it was for me," Henry said, eyes back on hers. "Truthfully, I don't know that she named you for me, so much as for a moment in time. I suppose you are a tribute, a kind of memory to who we were. It's, well, it's unexpected, given the way she left us."
Etta didn't trust her voice enough to speak. Her whole life, all 18 years of it, her father had lingered as a kind of question mark in the background. A ghost that came around haunting now and then in her thoughts, to remind her of the loss, to expand that gap in her family portraits. But there had been many ghosts, and many gaps on both sides of her family, and Etta had never let herself dwell on any of them in particular, because it seemed ungrateful in the face of everything and everyone she did have. Father. A word from a vocabulary of love she'd never learned. Etta couldn't make any more sense of it than she could of the way she felt. An involuntary, panicked elation that left her feeling like she needed to run to him, or away from him. "What am I doing here?" Etta asked finally.
"At first, we only wanted to protect and heal you. You were almost dead when Julian Ironwood brought you back to us. From here on out, well," he said, "I should like to hope you will aid us against Ironwood, considering all he's done to you. And if I'm lucky, you might tell me a little about yourself, beyond what I know."
"Which is what?" she asked, shocked by the eagerness in his voice.
"That you were born and raised in Manhattan, that you enjoy reading, and were homeschooled from a young age. I know that you have performed across the world in many competitions, and that you feel very strongly about Bach over Beethoven."
"You read the Times article," she said quietly.
"I read everything I could find from this internet creation," he admitted.
He said internet like he was testing the word in his mouth for the first time.
"Not nearly enough. There's one question in particular I've had for weeks now, and I desperately wish you'd consider answering it, but only if you are comfortable."
The way he framed it satisfied her pride and appealed to her curiosity. But there was one weight she needed to remove before she could continue. "I need you to answer a question for me first," Etta said. "But I don't know if I can even trust your answer."
"Ask and see."
She took a pacifying breath, waiting until the pain in her throat eased enough to speak normally. "The night of the concert, were you or any of your thorns involved in a shooting?"
There.
A flicker of something in his face. Henry's lips compressed, and she heard the harsh breath leave his nose.
"Do you mean Alice?"
Etta had expected a quick dismissal, an annoyed defense. But that softness in his expression rubbed at the fragile shield she'd constructed around her heart, and the heaviness in his words nearly cracked it altogether. She swallowed again, nodded. It was a long while before he spoke again. And the whole time he never broke his gaze away from her. Etta could see his mind working, as if deciding how best to continue. Or was he deciding what she could handle?
"Never," he told her. "I would never harm Alice. Though I'm not sure she felt the same about me. I believed her when she said she tried to stop you from traveling. To protect you."
She told you that? A rebellious thought rose in her. Alice trusted him.
After you disappeared, I stayed with her, he said.
The word slammed through at his heart, making it throb in her chest with a mess of relief and gratitude and envy.
Her last thoughts were only of you.
She wasn't alone. Alice didn't die alone. Atta pressed a hand to her face, drawing in breath after breath to stave off the crush of tears. She wasn't alone.
She wasn't alone, he said softly. She shouldn't have suffered that at all, but at least there was that one small bit of mercy.
Atta heard him shift, his feet moving against the carpet, but he didn't reach for her, didn't feed her comforting lies. He remained nearby, silent, ready, until the metronome of her heart slowed enough for her to find her center again. Thank you, Atta managed. For staying with her until the end? He nodded.
The honor was mine. Are you satisfied with your answer?
Yes, she said. What was your question?
Did your mother give you any sort of traveling education and training? Henry asked. The fact that you so willingly followed the Ironwood girl made me think not. And yet it's so unlike your mother not to have thought through something 5 steps past everyone else. And there should have been any number of precautions to protect you against this.
Etta gritted her teeth at the humiliation that itched inside of her. The embarrassment at being so unprepared for a traveler's life was familiar, but feeling it now meant that she cared what this man thought of her. She didn't want him to somehow think less of her. I didn't know I could travel until the night of the performance. His hand rasped over the faint stubble along his chin and jaw, eyes softening in a way that made her hate herself, just a little bit, for how much she appreciated it.
None of us are born speaking a 6 languages, or feeling at ease in the Roman Empire. You'll pick it up quickly enough, and there are many here, myself included, who would be happy to help you in any way we can.
Etta raised her eyebrows at that. From her unscientific survey, less than 1/2 of the thorns she'd met had been willing to look her in the eye. She did what she had to do, Etta said. Mom, I mean.
She did what she was told to do, Henry said,
rising again to his feet. He was tall, but not imposingly so. Yet when he moved, he took command over every inch of the space around him.
How can you not be angry with her? How can you defend her after everything she subjected you to?
There were so many ways she would have answered that, even a few days ago. But now Etta felt all of her explanations crumbling, slipping through her fingers like the hot dust of Palmyra.
She didn't come for you when you needed her most.
His face was strained as he spoke.
She let you fall into Ironwood's trap.
She had... Etta had taken care of herself the best she could, tried to wrest some control from the situation, but it didn't change that simple fact.
He's holding her prisoner, Etta explained.
There was nothing she could do. He might have... already killed her. Henry made a noise of disgust, waving the thought away.
Your mother was free from Ironwood's men within days. I had numerous reports of her scampering about, staying well clear of you.
She's alive, Etta breathed out. The fear released like a sigh, blowing hot, then icy as what he didn't say finally set in. She's alive, and she didn't come to help me.
I can forgive her for what she did to us. She betrayed the trust of this group by lying and saying her family no longer had the astrolabe. The Thorns loved her, cared for her, and she took the key to everything we hoped to accomplish.
He raked his hand back through his hair again, mussing it further.
We've known each other since we were children, Rose and I. For a time, I truly believed I understood her better than I knew myself. I'm not proud to admit it, but I did not see just how ruthless and hopelessly misguided she had become. She is no stranger to using people, Thorns or Ironwoods. But for you to bear the brunt of it is cruel, even by her standards.
Etta didn't like that line of thought, the way it worked her stomach into disarray. She wanted to argue in her mother's defense, to call his own bias into question. But when she reached into her memories, she found she'd already run through what little evidence to the contrary she had. Making his way to the window, Henry looked out, keeping his face from her.
"There's so much darkness to this story. There are times I feel suffocated by it. Our lives became a tapestry of family and revenge and devastation, and it wove around us all so tightly, none of us escaped its knots. Not even you. I should have seen the signs, but I wanted to believe she was beyond it. You have to know that if I had known she was with child when she left, I never would have stopped looking for you. I would have gone to the very edges of time to save you from this."
"What are you talking about?" Etta pressed. Her fingers twisted around each other in her lap. She could almost hear the way her thoughts were swelling, racing through the beats of lies and secrets to one final, crashing crescendo. She didn't want to hear. She had to. His gaze met hers over his shoulder.
"All of this, this journey she sent you on, is rooted in nothing more than delusion and lies."
8. Rather than stay seated and speak to his back, Etta pushed the chair from the desk and padded over to him. Sunrise edged ever closer with each second, adding to the unrelenting pressing of time's swift march away from her. The sky near the horizon had lightened to a soft violet, and in the gentle light, she saw what wasn't there. The footprints of the decimated buildings and streets hidden by rubble. Streetlights that had been twisted and snapped like dry, long grass.
She began. But the story wasn't about her. Not yet.
"I don't know what you know of the Thorns. Of us," he said, giving her a sidelong glance as he clasped his hands behind his back. "I cannot claim we are without fault and failures. Many of us lost everything in the war against Ironwood. Families, fortunes, homes. A sense of safety and independence. But the people here are good and decent, and want to do something meaningful. We want to protect each other. It was your mother, you know, who came up with the name. It was something she used to say, that she could no longer be a rose without thorns. She nearly destroyed every hope we had of succeeding when she disappeared. Rose turned our castle to glass and left us exposed and one strike away from shattering."
"I know about all of that," Etta said. Rose had infiltrated the Ironwoods for a time to keep them from finding the astrolabe. She knew now she'd come back to the Thorns briefly before leaving for the future, with child. "I want to know what you meant by delusion. That's a strong word."
"I've never told anyone this, the more fool I," he murmured.
The reluctance in his tone made Etta step forward, as if to seize the secret he was offering.
"After her parents were murdered, Rose claimed she was visited by a traveler, one who warned that if Ironwood were to possess the astrolabe, it would result in some sort of endless, vicious war, which would destroy everything and everyone."
Etta made a sharp noise of surprise. Henry glanced over at her again, and seemed to be measuring her response.
"You have to understand that she was deeply, deeply unwell after their deaths. She witnessed them herself as a young child, and they were so gruesome I feel I must spare you the details."
Etta's gaze sharpened on him. "So you just dismissed it? Because she was an unwell little girl?" He held up his hands.
"I would never use that term lightly. She described this traveler as shining like the sun itself, golden, his skin and form flawless. She told me once that when he spoke, it was as if she heard his words in her mind, and that he could plant images in her thoughts. That even our shadows served him. Shadows."
Etta was at a complete loss for words, trying to reconcile this image of her mother with the stiff, immaculately put-together woman she'd grown up with. So, all of this was not a fantasy, but Her mind stumbled over the words. Hallucinations and delusions. If she was following Henry's thinking on this, Rose's parents' death had been so deeply traumatic, the psychological aftershock so damaging. It had eventually ruined not only Rose's life, but compelled her to ruin her daughter's as well. All of this was a lie. Her blood was pounding wildly inside of her, like the flapping of a bird's wings struggling against a fierce wind. A tiny figure at the edge of her memory tiptoed forward, hesitating, curling the ends of her bright blonde hair with her small fingers. Quiet, as always, so as not to disturb. Perfect, as always, so as not to disappoint. Only watching the careful, meticulous strokes of her mother's paintbrush against canvas from the doorway of her bedroom. Wondering if the reason her mother seemed to rarely speak to her was because her language was color and form, when Etta's was sound and vibration. Henry reached out a hand for hers, but jerked it back when Etta flinched. After a moment, he continued.
As a child, her grandfather helped her put off the notion. But years later, after she'd joined me in trying to restore the original timeline, she had a dream about that meeting with the Golden Man, as she called him. Her fixation was renewed. The fierce, lively person I knew withered away, and in her place grew someone who was paranoid, erratic. Rose would go for days without sleep, then disappear for weeks, only to return more level-headed, folding away more and more secrets inside of her. I wanted to help her, but she didn't believe she needed help, not even as her delusions worsened, and she claimed she could feel people watching her from the darkness. Each word pulled at a new thread in Etta, slowly unmaking her. I should have fought her on the plans to spy on the Ironwoods by ingratiating herself with them, but it was like trying to bend steel with my hands. And then she vanished, and for years I was afraid. I thought for certain she had ended her own life.
Her mother would never have surrendered, forfeited her life that way.
Are you all right?
He asked, his brow creased. Who would be? She wondered. Why did she hide it, then, instead of just destroying it? Etta asked instead. That's the only way to truly keep it out of Ironwood's hands, right?
It gets at a struggle we've felt for years, the debate we've been locked in.
He reached down to the satchel near his feet, removing a dark leather journal.
This came into our possession almost 20 years ago, when your great-grandfather Lyndon died. It's one of his ancestors' journals, one of the older record-keepers who compiled information from old traveler journals and tracked changes to the timeline. From her understanding of her old ancestors' legends, destroying the astrolabe would have a nullifying effect on any alterations to the original timeline.
Meaning, Etta said, it would revert to the exact thing you and this group are after, the original version of the timeline.
Yes, but at a steep cost, Henry said,
placing the journal back on the desk.
Do you know that passages collapse when a traveler nearby dies outside of their natural time?
Etta nodded.
Imagine losing the one thing that could reopen them in the event of someone becoming trapped, being forced to wait out years or decades in an unwelcoming time, separated from your family, he said. There used to be thousands of passages, and now there are only a few hundred. Many would argue that as more of us die than are born, our way of life will vanish as the last passages close.
But not you.
Not me, he said. I understand that not everyone uses the passages for their own selfish ends, the way Ironwood does. Many simply need them to visit members of their family and friends who can't travel, or to conduct studies and research. Even your mother felt that way, unwilling to potentially risk losing her family in other centuries. But recent events have proven to me that this has become a necessity if we're to restore what's rightfully meant to be.
The buzzing static in Etta's ears finally exploded, swallowing his words. Some part of her strained against what he was asking of her. She didn't want this information, didn't want to know this, or put the pieces together.
"This doesn't make sense," she said,
hating the desperation in her voice, as she reached for logic to protect her heart.